Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 17th of May, these are our main stories. Israel tells the UN's highest court that accusations of genocide are a distortion of facts as it defends its military campaign in Gaza.
When dealing with the law, facts matter. Calling something a genocide again and again does not make it genocide.
Aid starts arriving in Gaza from a temporary pier constructed by the US military, but the UN says it's not enough for the dire humanitarian situation there and calls for land crossings to be reopened.
The stocks of food inside Gaza are virtually consumed, and it's virtually impossible to plan an aid operation where you don't know where the war is going next.
Also in this podcast, scientists believe they've solved the mystery of how dozens of pyramids were built in Egypt. We start in The Hague, where Israel has defended its military operations in Gaza at the United Nations highest court. Israel was responding to South Africa's call for the International Court of Justice to order a stop to Israeli military action in the city of Rafah, where many displaced Palestinians had sought shelter, and across Gaza. South Africa has also accused Israel of genocide in the Gaza war. Lawyer Gilad Noam told the court that South Africa was presenting biased and false claims.
South Africa presents the court yet again with a picture that is completely divorced from the facts and circumstances. It makes a mockery of the heinous charge of genocide. As Israel has previously stated before this court, when dealing with the law, facts matter. Truth should matter. Words must retain their meaning. Calling something a genocide again and again does not make it genocide.
Fighting has been raging around Rafah following an Israeli operation which began around 10 days ago. Israel says it's vital if it is to eradicate Hamas. The UN says the past week has seen at least 600,000 people fleeing Rafah in a vain search for safety. Mr. Noam insisted that Israel had acted in accordance with international law and its humanitarian obligations. Our correspondent, Anna Holligan, is at the court in The Hague, where she told us more about Israel's robust response.
Israel describes South Africa's case as an inversion of reality divorced from the facts. Israel's lawyers accuse South Africa of exploiting the Genocide Convention and presenting outlandish allegations. The most repugnant among them, the lawyers said, were claims that Israel had created zones of extermination, so using language reminiscent of the Holocaust, making efforts to link the situation in Rafah today with the genocide in Srebrenica. The hearing is over. We've just heard from South Africa, some of the South African delegation on the steps of the Peace Palace home to the International Court of Justice. Israel won't be making a statement today, but South Africa's team said that what we're witnessing is a live stream of genocide in Gaza, and Israel is asking us not to see what we have seen with our own eyes. So really strong language from both sides today.
And when are we expecting an ICJ ruling on this?
The ICJ is dealing with this as a matter of urgency. Usually rulings in provisional measures cases take 1 or 2 weeks, so we would expect something relatively soon. And just to remind you what South Africa has asked for here, South Africa wants the judges to urgently order Israel to, first of all, withdraw from Rafah, to call a ceasefire. Secondly, to ensure adequate humanitarian aid access, access for UN investigators, access for journalists. So if any violations of the Genocide Convention are being committed, the evidence can be gathered and preserved. Israel said there is no violation taking place. And if the judges were to rule in this case in South Africa's favour, then Israel said this court would be denying Israel's right to defend itself and also would be empowering Hamas to continue to commit the crimes.
Anna Holligan in The Hague. In Gaza itself, a temporary pier built by American troops has been used for the first time to deliver humanitarian aid to the Palestinian territory. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Dan Johnson, says with food and medicines in short supply across Gaza as land crossings remain closed, this new aid route is a welcome development.
It enables larger ships to dock with aid consignments that are being shipped from Cyprus, and they are then ferried to the shore. So this is another route for aid to reach the hungry Palestinian refugees of Gaza. But the emphasis by the US, the UN and others involved in this operation is that this is a temporary measure, that it is additional, that it does not replace the aid flows that should be continuing through Gaza's land borders. And that has been a serious issue over the last week, particularly with the Rafah crossing with Egypt having been closed after Israel's military moved in on the Gaza side of that border crossing. That was somewhere that was key to the delivery of aid for the Palestinians even before the current conflict. And the emphasis is that even though this is a positive step that will enable some aid shipments to dock and directly deliver to Gaza's shores, that the land borders, the land routes, need to be re-established, secured and maintained so that proper aid, enough food, enough fuel, shelter and medical supplies can be brought in for the hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees, particularly those from Rafah itself, who have been on the move again in the last week or so with the intensifying military operations around Rafah, around that city.
Well, the UN says the humanitarian situation in Gaza remains dire and has called again for those land crossings to be opened immediately to bring in aid. Here's the UN humanitarian aid chief, Martin Griffiths.
The stocks of food inside Gaza are virtually consumed. The dangers of movement are very clear for the people of Rafah and for the humanitarian workers involved in Gaza in responding to their needs. This is what we feared. And it's virtually impossible to plan an aid operation where you don't know if there's going to be fuel, where you don't know where the war is going next, and where you don't know how many more people are going to move and where to.
The UN's Martin Griffiths. China has announced some of its most sweeping measures yet to try to shore up its crisis-hit property market. It will allow local governments to buy up empty homes from developers to convert them into affordable housing. And it's also easing mortgage rules. China's property sector accounts for about a fifth of the economy, with millions of jobs dependent on it. And it's slumped in the past few years after the authorities cracked down on developers' high reliance on debt for growth. Our business reporter, Nick Marsh, told us more about China's property crisis.
Well, it has its roots in the huge property boom at the beginning of this century, which kind of went in tandem with China's more general economic boom. And without going into too much of a history lesson, basically, property developers saw that there was huge money to be made in building. Chinese middle class want to put their money into property as an investment. That's generally what they tend to do. And to put it very simply, developers borrowed too much money to build too many houses that not enough people want to buy. And the consequence is a huge oversupply of housing right now. And you've got this phenomenon of like ghost cities, you know, huge, massive, gleaming structures of thousands of apartments with barely anyone living in there. And you can imagine what that does to house prices. It sends them crashing down. And like you said, if a fifth of the economy was even, it was more actually a few years ago, is housing and property prices are going down, that's really going to hurt the Chinese economy. It's going to hurt ordinary people as well.
Yeah, and if it hurts the Chinese economy, it may have knock-on effects on other world economies. Just tell us about these latest measures to try to deal with this crisis, which has been going on for some years now.
It's been going on for some years, and the Chinese government's been in a bit of a dilemma as to how to deal with it. Because on the one hand, you don't want to be seen to bail out these property companies like Evergrande, Country Garden, these are names you might have heard of. Because if you do that, well, that basically isn't punishing them for overextending themselves and speculating too much. But you can't carry on with this situation of empty apartments. So they've tried to do really the only thing they can do, and that's to encourage local governments to buy up these empty apartments. We don't know how many, we don't know when it's going to happen, but the idea is if the local governments, which read local government, that's the state government, you know, they do what they're told more or less, if they start buying up these flats and they convert them into affordable housing, things like that, then that oversupply is going to start to decrease a little bit. It's a really long-term structural issue, Jeanette, and it's starting with these measures. Don't forget, China is a managed economy, so they can move money around if and when they deem necessary, but this is going to take a long, long time to fix.
So it sounds like we don't have the full details yet, but it could be quite controversial. Some people could see this as a bailout, and there is a potential for social unrest here.
It is a bailout, I suppose, because it's local governments basically spending public money in the end to buy these apartments. But I think there'd be much more social unrest if the current situation was allowed to continue, which is basically a situation where people have put hundreds of thousands of the equivalent of dollars in their money, of their money, into apartments that don't even exist, that haven't even been built yet. So I think people in China want to see their apartments be built and be able to actually see something for their investment and see the government actually taking action in some way. I think that's what the priority is. So I think it's trying to avoid more social unrest, or discontent really is probably a more accurate word. That is kind of motivating the Chinese government to take these measures.
Nick Marsh. Staying with China, Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin have vowed to work together against what they say is destructive and hostile US pressure, and to deepen the ties that have sustained Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Mr. Putin has been given a lavish welcome during a two-day state visit to China. Many fear that China might try to take Taiwan by force. But in an interview with the BBC, Taiwan's president says she doesn't believe an attack from China is imminent. Tsai Ing-wen says Taiwan is militarily much stronger today than it was when she came to power 8 years ago. And the cost to China of invading the island would be huge. The Taiwanese president spoke about her record in an exclusive interview with our Asia correspondent, Rupert Wingfield Hayes.
This isn't something you're going to see in the halls of power in Beijing. This is the sound of Taiwan's most famous drag act performing in front of Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, inside the grand entrance lobby of the presidential building in Taipei. It was one of the final events President Tsai hosted before she's due to step down next Monday. To the casual observer, President Tsai Ing-wen doesn't look like a revolutionary. She's a softly spoken former law professor, sometimes described as Asia's Angela Merkel. But Taiwan's first female president has quietly transformed this place into arguably the most progressive society in this region. For example, Taipei now hosts the largest gay pride festival in Asia. And in 2019, against fierce opposition, President Tsai's government pushed through legislation making Taiwan the first place in Asia to legalise same-sex marriage.
People thought I'm some sort of unusual happening.
As she prepares to step down after 8 years, I sat down with President Tsai at her home in Taipei and asked her why she chose this particular fight.
You were well ahead of any other country in Asia in pushing through that legislation. Why was that such an important priority for you?
It's a test to the society here to see to what extent they can move forward with their values. It was a very difficult journey. I am actually rather proud that we managed to overcome our differences.
The other huge test that has hung over her presidency is dealing with the growing military threat from China. President Xi Jinping's meeting with Vladimir Putin in Beijing this week is a reminder of the scale of forces arrayed against Taiwan. I recently accompanied President Tsai as she opened a new special forces training base on the outskirts of Taipei.
So I guess for President Tsai, this is a sort of demonstration of what she's been trying to achieve in defence policy over the last 8 years, because part of her big thing is that Taiwan doesn't spend enough on defence. When she came in, it was about 2% of GDP. She's managed to push that up to about 2.5% of GDP. A lot of people say Taiwan needs to be spending north of 3% of its GDP to have an effective military, given the huge threat that it faces from China.
What your critics would say is Taiwan cannot hope by itself to deter China militarily.
The cost of taking over Taiwan is going to be enormous. Chinese leadership have to make a good calculation as to whether they are prepared to pay the cost. What we need to do is to increase the cost of an invasion.
Today, Taiwan produces most of the world's really cutting-edge computer chips. An attack on the island would arguably be far more damaging to the world's economy than Russia's invasion of Ukraine. President Tsai thinks the democratic world should care about Taiwan for a different reason, because it is a remarkable beacon of freedom and democracy.
China, of course, would say that we're part of them. It's for the people to interpret what Taiwan represents. The most important thing is that we are on our own and we are a democracy.
That was the Taiwanese president, Tsai Ing-wen, talking to Rupert Wingfield Hayes. And you can watch the full conversation on the interview on the BBC News Channel. For thousands of years, it's been one of the world's great mysteries. Just how were the pyramids in Egypt built? Now, scientists say they think they've solved the mystery of how dozens of pyramids, including the world-famous Giza complex, were constructed. They've discovered a long-lost and ancient branch of the River Nile, which is now hidden under desert and farmland, using surveys, satellite imagery, old maps, and sediment samples. They say the waterway would have been used to float stone blocks. Suzanne Onstein is an associate professor at the University of Memphis and co-wrote the study.
We have evidence that they used the river as transport for large things like obelisks. They dragged huge stones and statues on that kind of log system. And getting all of that heavy stuff as close as possible to the building site. And that includes not just stones, but massive amounts of food to support the population, grain and meats and vegetables from all over for the work crews. So there's a lot of stuff other than just the heavy building stones that those harbors and access to the river would have been important for.
So what are the big unanswered questions about the pyramids that archaeologists are still trying to find out?
We have all of these sort of little pieces of evidence that we can string together to speak about the building of the pyramids, that some of the stone was quarried nearby, that some of it was being delivered from the Red Sea, that some of it's quarried further south. But there's no smoking gun instruction manual that says first you drag a stone here and then you build a ramp and then you drag it up the ramp and put it on top. There are pyramids with different construction styles in this whole stretch of pyramids. So we can't really say that there's only one way that this happened.
Suzanne Onstein, Associate Professor at the University of Memphis, speaking to Alex Ritson. Weeping statues, healing relics and divine apparitions. Some have been recognised by the Vatican to be credible and, in fact, miraculous, while others have been judged by church officials to be superstitious mumbo-jumbo. These are themes addressed in the Vatican's new guidelines on what it calls supernatural phenomena, which are being published today. Stefan Jejcznik reports.
The town of Lourdes nestles in a valley at the foot of the pyramid.
The Virgin Mary at Lourdes and Fatima. Hugely important places of pilgrimage for the Catholic Church. There are sites like this dotted all over the world, where Catholics believe supernatural phenomena, like apparitions of Mary, the Mother of Jesus, have taken place. But for every pilgrimage site, there are dozens of other sightings. Apparitions, weeping statues, and healing relics. But how does the Catholic Church decide which apparitions or supernatural goings-on are considered legitimate? While there is no department for the supernatural in Rome, nearly 50 years ago, authorities there drew up a set of guidelines for bishops who were given the responsibility of deciding this. Known as norms, they were written in Latin and only translated in 2011 on the orders of Pope Benedict XVI, supposedly after an increase in the number of reported apparitions and to avoid wider confusion. More than a decade on, Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, who leads the Vatican department responsible for religious discipline, has been charged with updating these guidelines. While the Catholic Church has been coy so far about what exactly will change, it's thought the rise of social media and an increase in the potential for stories to go viral is part of the move.
Stefan Jajecznik. Still to come in the podcast, the row that's broken out in Australia over an unflattering portrait of the country's richest woman. Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The political crisis in Georgia came to a head this week when the country's parliament finally voted through a highly controversial foreign agent law that sparked weeks of mass protests. Under the bill, non-governmental organisations and independent media that receive more than 20% of their funding from foreign donors will have to register as organisations bearing the interests of a foreign power. It's been nicknamed the Russian law by opponents who say it has a lot in common with a similar bill that came into force in Russia just over a decade ago and which has been used by the Kremlin since then to silence dissent. One of the leading opponents of the bill is Georgia's president, Salome Zurabichvili, who can veto the bill, although she can't ultimately overrule parliament. My colleague, Victoria Uwankunda, asked her how critical a moment this is for Georgia.
Well, it's critical, and that's why there are so many people on the streets for now 37 days exactly, and with sometimes more than 200,000 people. It's very critical because we are at very close to the door of the European Union. We have received the status of candidate. We are moving down that path, and we have the chance or the opportunity to reach by the end of the year, hopefully, the opening of negotiations of accession. And exactly at this time, when we should be working, the parliament should be working actively on the reforms that are still needed to be delivered in order to get this possibility. At this time, instead of doing that, and we have an agenda of reforms that is still long, we are discussing a law that was rejected last year, that there was a promise of the authorities never to represent it. There is no argumentation of why it has been represented, except that it provokes polarization, and it's a form of provocation to a country that is waiting to progress on the path towards Europe to present a law that is clearly understood by all our partners and by the society as an obstacle to Europe.
Madam President, you have said that you will veto the bill. However, your position as president is more of a ceremonial role with the prime minister as the head of government because Georgia is a parliamentary democracy and the ruling party has a majority in parliament. Is this a risk of back and forth with this bill? Why are you getting involved?
I'm getting involved because I am without executive powers or legislative powers, that's clear, but I've been elected by the population, so I'm answerable to them. And their voice today, which I'm hearing, is that they do not want to risk with this bill to lose their European chance. So they know, and I know, that my veto is going to be overpassed because they have a majority. But that doesn't matter. Sometimes politics is about symbols, and it's about expressing clearly a position, and that's what I'm going to do. I'm siding with the part of the population, and that's a very vast majority that for years now has been saying that it wants a European future. And that is the declaration, in a way, the statement that I'm making with a veto. And then we'll go back to the next stage, which are the elections in October. And that's where really the future of the country will be decided, because we have to, in fact, abolish not only this law, but a number of other laws that are not less anti-European in essence and its substance. And that can be done only through elections, when the Georgian population will clearly say what future it wants, that it wants Europe, which I do not doubt. And then we can pick up on our European path where it was left and remove those artificial obstacles that were set by this all range of laws that are not going according to the values of Europe or to the objectives of Europe.
You said earlier when we were speaking that Georgia is very close to the door of the EU, and foreign ministers from across Europe were just in Georgia and they met with you in solidarity. The Lithuanian foreign minister said, and I'm quoting what he said, "This is a battle for democracy, freedom and European future." Is that how you see this too?
Yes, that's what I'm saying, that we are at a critical moment, a moment that I'm sure will be overcome, but it will be overcome peacefully through the elections, when clearly the Georgian people will say what future they want for the country. And I have no doubt about what they want, because it's what Georgia has wanted since day as never may be. The Georgian population knows that independence of this country is linked to its European future. There is no other future without Europe and without independence.
Is Georgia's story is the same as Ukraine's, as an attempt to break away from Russian influence?
No, we have broken away from Russian influence a very long time ago.
They do still have 20% of your territory that they occupy, though.
Certainly, but what is interesting and what should be noted is that the fact that we had a war, and not only one, we had one in 91 and another one in 2008, Georgia has not changed its path towards Europe. Despite the 20% of the occupied territory, it has not neutralized Georgia, and Georgia is determined to continue on this path, which is not a confrontational path with Russia, but it is a very determined path to have and bring our own future in our hands.
Well, that was Georgia's president, Salome Zurabishvili, speaking to Victoria Uwankunda. Nearly a week on from the deadly flash flooding in northeastern Afghanistan, more information is emerging of what happened in the remote villages where the water hit. Among them are stories of rescues. Our correspondent, Caroline Davis, and her team have visited the area of Burka, where they spoke to two families who told them of the incredible moment a 10-year-old girl was pulled alive from the floodwaters.
This is the sound of the raging mud-brown torrent of water rushing down the main street of Falul village. The floods came suddenly, violently. Noor Ahmed and his family made it onto the roof of their home. But then the walls gave way, plunging all eight into the thick, fast-flowing water.
When the wall fell, I remember thinking I have lost everything. We are all finished. I was underwater and was hoping, oh God, please take my life so my problems will be over.
We speak to Noor in a canvas tent pitched where his home used to be. He survived by clinging to an almond tree, but his 10-year-old daughter, Zulika, had disappeared.
She was trying to grab onto things, but couldn't keep a grip. She said that finally she reached a field and floated on her back, thinking if I stand, the flood will take me again. Then she heard a voice, a man asking me, whose daughter are you?
Across the street from Noor's house, another rescue was taking place. In footage filmed on the roof of a mosque, children sit huddled, shaking, every inch coated in thick, sticky mud. They were dragged from the floodwaters. Habib Ullah was one of the men to save them.
I was in the mosque when the flood came through the door. We were all underwater. Some managed to get on the roof, and with the help of others, we knocked through a window. I tied the children with a shawl. Then my friend pulled them up to the roof.
He shows me them one by one. Some have cuts and bruises on their heads and faces. In total, we count eight, the youngest just 3 months old, that were saved. Meanwhile, downstream, someone had spotted Zulika, stuck in the branches of an uprooted tree. 18-year-old Alamuddin waded in to help.
My father and mother said, "Don't go there, you will be taken by the flood." But my heart felt for her. There was a feeling I had in myself that I can do it.
He points to his chest.
The water came up to here. I took her on my back and I got her to our house. Most parts of her body were injured.
This is the sound from a video taken of Zulakha after she was rescued. Shaken, muddied, but alive. She's now recovering at her relative's. Her father, Noor, had never met the family that saved his daughter's life. When they arrive at his tent, he starts to cry as he thanks them.
Right now, I don't have anything. If I give you the whole world, it won't be equal with what you did for us.
These are stories from one corner of one village about those who did what they could to save others from the waters.
Caroline Davis with that story of a remarkable rescue in Afghanistan. To France now, where police have shot dead a man who set a synagogue on fire in the northwestern city of Rouen. The French Interior Minister, Gérald Darmanin, praised the police for what he said was their fast reaction and courage. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
Police were called shortly before 7 a.m. after smoke was seen rising from the synagogue in central Rouen. When they arrived at the scene, they were confronted by a man wielding a knife and an iron bar. When he appeared to advance on them, one of the police shot him dead. The mayor of Rouen said the man had climbed into the synagogue via an upstairs window and thrown in a Molotov cocktail. He said there was severe damage to the inside of the synagogue, but no people were hurt. Like many other countries, France has seen a rise in anti-Semitic incidents since the start of the war in Gaza.
Hugh Schofield. Australia's richest person is not happy. Gina Rinehart, an heiress and mining magnate, may possess a fortune reportedly worth more than $30 billion, but she's upset by a painting at the National Gallery of Australia. It's a rather unflattering portrait of her, showing her with wonky eyes and a huge double chin, as Mickey Bristow, our Asia Pacific editor, told me.
It's pretty unflattering, this picture, as you mentioned just there. She's looking very jowly, wide-eyed, pink, flushed skin. Really, really a poor depiction of Gina Rinehart. In defence of the artist, this picture is one of a number, a series of portraits of people who have shaped Australia, and they're all caricatures. And so it fits in this series. I have to say, though, Gina Rinehart's picture is slightly worse than most of the others.
So tell us more about her.
Gina Rinehart, she's the richest person in Australia. She inherited a mining company from her father, but turned that around and has really increased its wealth. She's also into agriculture, moved into media. She's also a really larger-than-life figure. She's outspoken on a number of political issues about too much taxation. She's also supported climate change deniers in the past. She's even had arguments which have gone to the court with her own family, three of her four children, her mother-in-law, just to name a few people she's been in court with. So really, she's an outspoken figure. So it's not necessarily unexpected to see her being angry about this particular painting.
And how have other people been reacting to the painting and to this controversy?
Yeah, it's interesting this, Riau, actually, how it's played out, because she's a major philanthropist and so she's put millions and millions, particularly into sport in Australia. So a lot of key swimmers in the country and lots of swimming organisations have actually supported her dislike of this picture and have asked actually the gallery itself if they would take it down. Inevitably, though, you've got lots of people on the other side of the argument who think, look, this is artistic expression. People should be allowed to paint what they want. And it's a dangerous precedent just to take down a picture because some particular person doesn't like it. Interestingly, the artist himself, Vincent Namajoy, is an Aboriginal artist. He said he's painted this series of pictures to make people think about influence and privilege. He says he just paints the world exactly as he sees it. So that's the last word, really, from him.
Well, and paradoxically, Gina Rinehart's complaints probably mean many more people are going to see this portrait than would have done otherwise.
Exactly. It's the age-old problem, isn't it? When you complain about something, nobody sees it. You make the complaint, everybody in the world sees it.
Mickey Bristow, and you can see the portrait as well as the others in the exhibition on the BBC News website. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Hansen. The producer was Vanessa Heaney. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.